President Obama has another plan to cut spending.
This time, he wants to consolidate Washington.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org on this Friday, the 13th.
Uh-oh. Well, it's already been a weird day in China where an Apple store got an egging.
Mm. Is red wine good for you or not?
And later, why Penn State fans are acting a bit like unhappy shareholders.
Well, those stories and more still to come on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
President Obama is outlining plans today to shrink the government. He's going to ask Congress to give him the authority to merge departments and agencies. His plan starts by consolidating six government offices involving trade and commerce. Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The White House says it can save $3 billion over 10 years by combining related agencies like the U.S. Trade Representative and the Export-Import Bank and the Small Business Administration. New York University government professor Paul Light says that may be easier said than done because every government office has powerful political supporters.
All these agencies are owned by congressional committees and subcommittees, and it's difficult to do without some sort of expedited authority that provides an up-and-down vote.
The president will say he has other ideas for streamlining government and wants Congress to commit to voting on them within 90 days after he proposes them. Light figures all told there could be $100 to $150 billion in savings from eliminating duplication and bureaucracy across the government. Light says Republicans do support leaner government, and the president will ask them to step up to the plate, even though they may be reluctant to give this president more power. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, the plan John was just talking about is a fitting end to a week in which the whole idea of downsizing came under the microscope. Not downsizing in the public sector, but in the private sector. I'm talking, of course, Steve, about the attacks on Republican presidential frontrunner Mitt Romney's time at Bain Capital,
right,
a private equity firm that made its money by taking over companies and cutting costs, often in a painful way. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us from New York, as he is every Friday. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with a clip from an anti-Romney video that is running in South Carolina this week with very sad stories of people who were laid off from companies taken over by Bain while Romney was in charge.
Their livelihoods was there. They were making a good wage. And this company comes in and they knock it all away. They knock their wages down. They take their jobs away. And then eventually they closed the plant.
All right. So, Chris, a very sad story from a woman who was laid off. And I want to ask you, are the things that private equity firms like Bain do necessary in our economy, or is this needless cruelty?
Yeah, this is sort of the nature of the business cycle. It's what economists call creative destruction. And I guess that's why we get called dismal scientists. It's the ugly side of markets, which is that capital often ends up in places where it cannot earn a return. And we go through a process of ultimately having to cut those areas back. It is painful. It is ugly. But by freeing up the capital, it can be put to work in other places, hopefully creating jobs elsewhere.
Well, I think the other thing that people get so angry about, though, when they hear about these kinds of things, is that as these private equity firms are shutting down businesses, they're often the people in charge of them are making hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's two things to think about there. One of them is that the investors in that company, ultimately, if the company's not profitable and it's not profitable forever, the company's going to go out of business. There'll be no return on investment. They're willing to pay a lot to someone who can come in and turn that around. Whether it's too much, you know, that's something the voters have to decide. And whether the right cuts are made or it's fair, I think we're going to have a long discussion about this as long as Romney's the front runner.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we got the first bank earnings report today, and it was J.P. Morgan Chase that reported a lower profit in the last 3 months of the year, down by 23%. The European debt crisis and, of course, the sour economy weighed on investment deals and trading. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's usually with us from New York on Fridays, except today she's with us right here in our studio in Los Angeles. Hey, Jill, welcome.
Great to be here.
Unless you're a shareholder or maybe work at J.P. Morgan Chase, why do we care how they're doing?
You know, big banks, when they don't make money, they really are starting to say, well, how do we deliver something of value to our shareholders? And they're going to try to make up the loss of investment banking and trading income by what? By raising fees. And that's where those consumers are going to go nutty, because we're going to start to see more and more bank fees pop up in places we've never seen them before. Check those statements carefully. I think you're going to be unpleasantly surprised.
All those fees to compensate. All right. So what's new about this report? I mean, the economy's supposedly getting better, right?
Well, you know, an interesting thing happened. At the bottom of the market, which is the spring of 2009, the Federal Reserve basically lowered rates and banks borrowed money for essentially 0%. They went and invested that and made some easy money right through about the end of 2010. What this really says is less about the economy and more that the easy money has been made already. These banks are having a harder time making money because you can't just borrow at zero, invest, and make money. So they are going back to old-fashioned things. They have to actually bid for deals. They have to get consumers to say, yes, we want to use your services. They have to convince people to go into their private wealth management. These are old-fashioned notions. It is harder and harder for them to make money.
And that's the way of the future?
I think it's the wave of the near-term future. How about that? These things are probably—
Anything could change, right?
But 10-year cycles. But the best days of the big banks and Wall Street firms are definitely behind them for a while. They're going to go back to the basics. It's going to be harder for them to make money. They'll reduce headcount. They'll reduce compensation. They need to right-size their individual businesses to match what's happening in the sector and in the economy.
We're going to get a bunch of other bank earnings next week, of course. And do you think this gives us some sort of indication of what we're going to see in those reports?
I don't think there's much special about J.P. Morgan, although they may be the strongest of all the banks. I think we'll see a very, very consistent message. Harder to make money, lower earnings, really much bleaker outlook.
Bleaker outlook for the banks in general.
Yeah, for all the banks and everyone in financial services.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch, live here in the studio with us in Los Angeles. Jill, thanks.
Great to be here.
Well, Jill, Steve, banks like Chase are having a harder time squeezing more money out of consumers to make up the revenue that they've been losing from other parts of the business. In fact, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, all the fees have driven some consumers away from banks altogether.
Many of the working poor don't use banks because the fees make the services too expensive. Now new fees could drive existing customers away from banks. Kimberly Gartner is with the nonprofit Center for Financial Services Innovation.
We're seeing banks exploring different fees on some of their checking account products or deposit account products. And some consumers, as a result of that, are choosing to go elsewhere for their services.
But some banks are starting to see the benefit of keeping and attracting low-income consumers. Carl Carandi is with KPMG. It advises banks about the potential profits from services like check cashing and prepaid debit cards.
With some of the advances and the supporting technologies, banks can provide these at more competitive prices than they had in the past.
The unbanked represent a big market. KPMG estimates they number around 33 million people in the U.S. with almost $500 billion in earnings. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Now the global perspective on business and economics. There were riots today in China, but not because of a labor dispute or some kind of a human rights campaign. The trouble began when an Apple store in Beijing announced it was canceling the sale of the new iPhone 4S.
Wow.
And the company has now temporarily suspended sales at all Chinese stores. The people who had waited in line all night pelted the store with eggs, and a police tactical unit had to be called in. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Last year, at the launch of the iPad 2 in China, it was a fistfight in a smashed store window. Now this. Sean Ryan, author of the forthcoming book, The End of Cheap China, says Apple's underestimating itself in China.
They underestimate the popularity of Apple products. The iPhone 4S entered China months after entering the United States. They have their Siri, but doesn't even have Mandarin language capability, yet still you have people lining up all night long.
And after lining up all night, customers in Beijing were told to go home without their iPhones. The response was a barrage of eggs splattering against the modern glass exterior of the store. An Apple spokeswoman chalked it all up to the popularity of Apple's products. But Ryan says Apple simply doesn't get China.
They really have viewed China as a secondary market, which is a mistake, because we think the market could handle 100 Apple stores and that China should actually be a larger market for Apple than the United States. Demand here is high. People just go crazy for Apple products.
And that's because of the 300 stores Apple has globally, only 5 of them are in China. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, to Europe now, where things seem to be looking up. In Italy, the government was easily able to borrow $4 billion to pay for spending over the next 3 years. And the head of the European Central Bank says it is evidence that the new European bailout is paying off. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on that story. Stephen, why the newfound optimism there?
Italy and Spain borrowed $32 billion between them over the past 2 days, and they had no trouble at all. Investors shoveled their cash in, and as a result, their borrowing costs fell sharply.
Now, why, though, Stephen, is the European Central Bank claiming credit for that?
Because the central bank has made available hundreds of billions in cheap loans to the Eurozone commercial banks, and they're starting to lend that money to Eurozone governments, making it easier and cheaper for them to borrow, making it less likely they'll default.
So is this it? A crisis over?
Not quite, no. The European Central Bank is certainly working more effectively, but some analysts say the governments in the Eurozone still haven't done enough to get their finances under control. Steve Barrow of Standard Bank says that'll become more difficult if the Eurozone as a whole lurches into recession this year, as seems likely.
That's not the right sort of backdrop that you need to be able to get the budget deficit reductions that governments are promising.
And there's a lot more borrowing to do. The Eurozone as a whole needs to borrow almost $1 trillion before the end of this year.
Wow. All right. Marketplace is Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you so much.
Okay, Steve.
Tonight, Penn State's new president will host another town hall meeting with alumni about the sexual abuse scandal that's engulfed the university. It's the third in a series of confrontational question and answer sessions, or something akin to what you'd see from angry stockholders at some big company. Marketplace's Gregory Warner attended a forum last night, and he filed this report.
More and more, public colleges in this country feel like corporate America. Tonight, 650 Penn State alumni pack a Radisson Hotel conference hall like unhappy shareholders. In the front row sits Larry Grossman, class of 73.
While people I felt who were in control should have taken the bull by the horns, now the whole university is kind of tainted, and that really ticks me off.
So why being here is how is that going to help untaint it?
I don't know that it will untaint it, but it gives me a chance maybe to vent my anger, okay?
To vent and to vet the new CEO. I mean, university president Rodney Erickson, who replaced President Graham Spanier, dismissed in November. Grossman's family is still struggling over how much to donate to the alma mater, and so is Anne Marie Merrill, flanked by her sorority sisters.
That's what I'm here tonight to make a decision on, quite frankly. I am. I'm here. That's part of what I'm here for, to find out what do we do about these Penn State season football tickets? What are we going to do about the donations?
President Erickson gives a speech about openness and compassion and living up to Penn State values that lasts just 7 minutes. Then he sits in a plush chair on the long stage to take questions for an hour 15. Anthony Lebrano, a financial advisor and multimillion-dollar donor, says he's just come from Joe Paterno's house.
And Coach wanted me to share this with all of you, and he was very clear. He said, and I'll try to do my best Joe impression,
"Kid, remember, this is not about me. This is about our school."
So in spite of how we've treated him, he's still thinking about us first.
When it was all over, I asked the sorority alum, Anne Marie Merrill, what she decided about her donation.
I don't know. It just was more the same, and the audience contributed to asking the same questions over and over again. So I think football money is due February 1st, so I've got a couple weeks.
Another alum told me she's going to give even more this year, but earmarked. And first, she's going to go on the university website and actually read the budget. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Now to the UK, Steve, where there is a storm brewing over the apostrophe.
What?
Yes, the British bookstore chain Waterstones, that's Waterstone apostrophe S, yeah, has used the apostrophe in its name since its founding more than 30 years ago. But now they are shedding the apostrophe because the company says, in a digital world of URLs and email addresses, Waterstones without an apostrophe is more practical.
So they're trying to be less possessive.
That's right. That's right. Less possessive and easier to write waterstones.com or whatever it is. Right. Well, that is not going well with John Richards, Steve. I don't know if you know who John Richards is.
Hmm.
He runs the no joke Apostrophe Protection Society.
Oh, the APS, of course. The APS. Yes, I've heard of it. I have no idea who the APS is.
Why would anybody create this organization? I don't know. But but anyway, Richard says the bookstore could learn a thing or two about the English language from the apostrophe haven that is McDonald's.
McDonald's. There is an apostrophe in it.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, if McDonald's can do it, surely Waterstones can too, right? My gosh. Well, the University of Connecticut said this week that one of its scientists falsified data in a new study about red wine. You know, Jeremy, we talk about red wine and the benefits.
Is it good?
Drink,
is it bad?
Wow. The study found that drinking red wine slowed the aging process. Well, Marketplace's Eve Tro has more on that story.
Worst case scenario, one specific wine grape compound in the corrupted study turns out not to be a silver bullet. Best case scenario, plenty of studies still show that drinking some wine is a net positive, says Leslie Nolan at Radial Research.
We may not know how it works, but we feel pretty confident that a small amount of wine every day is for most people beneficial from a health standpoint.
She says American consumers often cling to health studies to justify things that are simply everyday pleasures in other cultures.
Making it okay to consume something we liked and we're doing anyway has obvious appeal to a lot of us. I mean, who's going to falsify data that says broccoli's really, really, really good for you?
Americans have been drinking more wine for 17 years straight, says Gladys Horiucci at the advocacy group The Wine Institute. But raising a glass to your health is not a primary market driver.
I think most people are choosing it because they simply like the taste and how it improves food and the overall dining experience.
Besides, by federal law, winemakers can't advertise any medical benefit for their Pinot, Cabernet, or Syrah. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Now to New Jersey, where the governor has just signed a bill to allow private firms to run some public schools. The move comes less than 2 weeks after the state of Ohio privatized several state prisons. For more on this wave of privatization, let's bring in Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, privatization of public space has been going on for a long time in this country, at least since the Reagan years. Is it happening a lot more now?
Oh, Jeremy, it's happening a lot more now. Now, part of it is, you know, state and local governments are under enormous pressure, so they need to raise money, so they'll privatize some public housing, maybe the parks. I mean, they're moving all over, but it really came home to me last weekend. I was at a conference, Mark Udoff, president of the University of California, and he was bemoaning and talking about the privatization of the public university, you know, the sense that, yes, you get a degree, you get lifetime earnings, that's a really good thing, therefore you should pay more, but he's worried about that trend.
Well, obviously, these organizations, whether they be universities or governments, are doing this because they are low on cash, as you say. Is there any way around this, Chris?
Oh, yes, there is, because in an earlier era, there was a lot more taxpayer support. There was a lot more public support. The public university isn't just a private good. It also is about being citizens, about the knowledge in our society, innovation, creativity, you know, everybody moving up together. And so what, you know, I worry about, whether you're looking at universities or parks or even things like prisons, you know, are we losing the sense of a social good, a social compact, the commonwealth, that we're all in this together?
Well, is anybody pushing back against this in a big way?
I think there's an enormous pushback going on. Now, privatization isn't exactly on the tip of everyone's tongue, but 99% is. And it's part of this discussion. What's the good of private equity? What do we do about income inequality? How about social mobility? Has privatization gone too far? This is all part of an important, dynamic discussion that's going on in our society.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, today is a sad day for us here at the Marketplace Midday Update because it is your last day with us at Marketplace.
It indeed is. And I have to mention on this podcast that I'm leaving to pursue the afternoon gig over at KCRW, which is 89.9 for listeners here in Los Angeles, and KCRW.com.
And one of the coolest stations in public radio.
It's a great radio station. It's a great opportunity. And believe me, I was more than just a little torn about what to do. But this was an incredible opportunity, and I'm so lucky to have it. So,
well, we've been lucky to have you, and we're glad that you are going to be here in L.A. for us. And we have a special surprise guest on the line for our midday extra today.
Oh my God.
And
I can't imagine who this is.
I will let this person introduce herself.
Hi, Steve.
Who?
It's Tess
host Bigland
from Marketplace Money.
What? Oh my gosh!
I'm calling you from all the way down the hall.
Didn't I just have coffee with you?
Well, you did indeed, and I just wanted to tell you how much I'm going to miss our trips to go have coffee, and how much I'm going to miss having you here in my office, just chit chatting away. But more than anything else, I'm really going to miss having you on my morning drive, my friend.
You are a dear friend of mine, and always will be, no matter where I am. And,
absolutely. Just because you're moving over to the west side doesn't mean I won't see you. Well, maybe I'll see you a couple times a year.
Absolutely. I make it out to Pasadena occasionally, so I am absolutely going to miss so many people here, Tess among them, and Jeremy, you too, and so many folks. I feel like this is an Oscar broadcast or something.
Since we have Tess on the line, I would just like to ask, because Tess has known you for a while.
Yeah.
Tess, is there anything embarrassing you can tell us about Steve in this moment?
Oh, my God.
There's plenty, but he's my dear friend, so I will not do so.
Tess has a nice holiday party, and I have not broken any dishes. Now, this is a good record for me. No dishes have been broken at Tess's house over the, four years that I've been going.
That's
there. So.
Pretty good record.
Well, Steve, all I can tell you is that I've been in your shoes. Leaving the Marketplace Morning Report, and I just warn you that it will take you at least a couple of months to get used to being on Dayside, so be prepared for that.
So I'm going to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and
you are
in
indeed.
A cold sweat. What? Where am I supposed to be?
Right. You can always stop by and see us. We'll be here as of 1 a.m., Steve.
Do you know what I'm really going to miss, Jeremy?
What?
I'm going to miss filling in for Tess when she goes on vacation.
That was one of my
favorite things, was to do Marketplace Money.
Well, best of luck, my friend.
Thank you, Tess.
Thanks,
Bigland.
Tess.
Wow.
Love you.
Love you, too. Jeremy, you are a fine professional. I'm going to miss you, my friend. And again, we will stay in touch. And so many folks here at this production house are going to be missed. And I'm speechless.
We will miss you. And best of luck at KCRW. We'll be listening, Steve.
Thanks,
in Los
Jeremy.
Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.